Tom Perata is the best-selling author of 9 works of fiction, including Election and Little Children, both of which were made into Oscar-nominated films, and The Leftovers, which was adapted into a critically acclaimed Peabody Award-winning HBO series. His other books include Bad Haircut, The Wishbones, Joe College, The Abstinence Teacher, 9 Inches, and his newest, Mrs. Fletcher. His work has been translated into a multitude of languages. He's been on the show twice before, both with The Leftovers and with The Abstinence Teacher. You can find those interviews up and available on our website. But today we are chatting about Mrs. Fletcher, all the things related to writing it. It is published by Scribner, and it's out and available now. Tom, welcome back.
Oh, thanks for having me again.
I love having you. You're always my, like, go-to writer for complicated sex, and this book did not disappoint.
I'm proud to play that role in your life.
Do you feel like complicated sex seeks you out, or do you feel like you seek it out?
I feel like complicated sex is sort of redundant. You know, I don't really think there's such a thing as simple sex. And I think that was one of the things that I was thinking about when I wrote this book, which is just, you know, how unstable the definition of what kinds of sex are permissible, the way that definition has changed in my lifetime and in, you know, the lifetime of somebody, say, my parents' age. Like, every generation seems to come up with a new way of having sex and thinking about sex, and I think it has created a lot of confusion, and I was just trying to explore, you know, various aspects of that confusion in the book.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to me because I, you know, as I was reading it and, you know, just living through the times we're living through now, it does become this question of, you know, human nature doesn't change and human sexuality, I don't think, changes, but technology has certainly changed, and our access to all kinds of different ideas has certainly changed over the last 10 or 20 years. And so does that technology, or does this access to, you know, a whole new range of possibilities through dating apps and Tinder and the accessibility of pornography and all of this stuff, does it have an impact on our brains and on our desires and on the way we think about sex and on the way, you know, and on the way we think about our accessibility to sex and all of that stuff? And I don't know if you came to any different conclusions in writing the book than you had before you started it, or, you know, if it was just kind of a fun thing to explore.
Well, I think the first, I got hung up on your very first comment, which is that sexuality doesn't change, because I actually think it has changed a lot, even in my lifetime. If we think of sexuality as not so much as just some innate urge, but some set of, like, practices, you know, mm-hmm. what we want to do, what we're allowed to do. And I do think that the proliferation of porn has really changed a lot of people's sexuality, because for one thing, it's made us aware of all sorts of practices that used to be so arcane, mm-hmm. and you know, but now you can find, you know, this sort of global community of people who are really excited about, you know, pony play or balloons or, you know, you can find, and, you know, I guess people have been having orgies for forever, but I think they're, you know, it's much easier to find them if you're interested and find other people who are, you know, and so things that maybe were in the realm of fantasy or even just sort of in some dark space before are now part of the repertoire of human sexuality and part of this sort of encyclopedic reservoir that, you know, that is porn, you know, just like every desire that you or I could think of is documented there, and it's available for people who are interested. And I think suddenly things are just, a whole new set of things are possible. I do also think that maybe does threaten some idea of conventional sexuality, like you should be happy with, you know, just this small set of behaviors and you know, monogamy, all these things that I think are, or you know, a binary definition of gender. Like, I think so many things are in flux right now, and part of that has to do with the fact that we're always looking around trying to figure out what other people are doing. And now with our access to porn, it's like they're doing everything.
Yeah. And it normalizes all these things that people may have felt ashamed of or weird about. Now they're like, oh, there's a whole community of people that think just like me, or, you know, and I can have it in like 10 minutes.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's very empowering if you, you know, felt like your desires were never going to be met by the world. On the other hand, you know, I think people who talk to young women, like Peggy Orenstein in that book, Girls and Sex, you know, there's a lot of talk about, you know, girls having their early sexual experiences with boys who have been steeped in porn. And you know, they have these expectations that I think the girls can find very alienating. You know, there's a certain kind of pressure to behave as if you're experienced when you're not. You know, I think there's just been a lot of, you know, there's both good and bad to the fact that technology has opened up, you know, the whole spectrum of sexuality to everyone.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, it is interesting to be on both sides of this. I have a teenage daughter, my junior in high school, and I said, you know, it's just a date, go have fun. And she's like, you don't really know what just a date means anymore. It doesn't mean just a date. I mean, it's you know, got all this expectation on it. And even if it's the first date, it's got all this expectation. I'm like, things have changed for sure. For sure.
They sure have. And you know, I won't ask you, you know, for your own, you know, your personal take on this, but I know I was talking to, some friends of mine who have teenage daughters, and they were like, well, they just get these, you know, these guys just send pictures of their penises now, you know, and it's like nobody wants them, but it's just a regular part of, you know, of some crazy version of courtship, you know, that I think has to do, again, with porn. It's some feeling of, like, this body part is my sexual self.
Yep. You know, I also... go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, no, and I do think, you know, they're just operating in a space that adults who came of age before smartphones and before internet porn, just honestly, they're often shocked. Like I talk to people my age who just want to pretend that it's not happening.
Yeah, right. My whole theory about those pictures is that you give the gift that you wish someone would give to you. Like every time, you know, my husband gets a birthday gift, he gives me like a really nice watch because he likes really nice watches. And I feel like that's what's going on with these guys, is they're like, what I would really like is for you to do this. And so I'm going to do this for you.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree. And I think it's wanting to be part of the conversation. You know, I think girls assume that guys want to see their bodies, you know, and rightly so, I think.
Yeah.
But these guys, I think it is some weird form of reciprocity, except that it's not always reciprocal, right? It's an attempt to start the exchange.
Right.
Rather than to you know, respond to an offer that's come before. So, yeah, but I think that is a kind of a sympathetic way to understand it, rather than an act of aggression or harassment, which I think it sometimes also is. Sometimes it is just a misguided attempt to be part of the discourse.
Exactly. I think you're right. And, you know, everything else that comes along with all of this, the acceleration of our conversation about transgender and transsexuality and asexuality and, you know, kind of the whole sexual spectrum, gender spectrum, really that whole conversation has accelerated so quickly in the past 10 or 15 years. And I think we're all kind of struggling to keep up with the conversation.
Yeah. And you know, this novel, Mrs. Fletcher, was really an attempt to wade into those waters because, among other things, I mean, it is a book about sex and identity, but it's also a book about college. And one of the things that I think has marked this, you know, the past couple decades, as you just said, is that certain academic ideas about gender and sexuality have entered the mainstream. And what I wanted to do is expose both of my characters, Eve Fletcher, who's a 46-year-old divorced mom, and her son Brendan, who leaves for college in the first chapter. They're both being exposed to sort of the current academic discourse about gender and sexuality, and they're both trying to sort of create workable adult sexual identities for themselves. And I think that the joke, you know, which is not, I don't use joke in a kind of, you know, diminishing way. The joke of the book is that it's the middle-aged woman who has what we think of as the college experience of having her mind open and experimenting with new forms of sexual behavior and creating a new identity and finding a new way to live, whereas her son is just in a kind of defensive crouch and wants to continue being the high school jock that he always was because that was a fun thing to be.
Yeah. It gave me hope for the next stage of life, that maybe life after your kids leave the house isn't completely devoid of fun. So.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that is certainly, you know, it's a subject I've returned to over and over again in my novels, which is to the extent that our society says fun is only available to people who are not yet adults, that adulthood is the end of fun. I think a lot of adults are, you know, rebelling against that and finding that to be like a pretty scary definition of maturity,
right.
You know? And so Eve is one of my characters who is just saying, you know, why can't I live the way I lived when I was, you know, before I was a parent, when there was, you know, my story was still there to be written.
Right, right. You have, across all of your novels, done such an incredible job of writing women. And I talk to a lot of writers who say it's almost easier to write about characters biographically different from themselves. And I wonder if you find that to be the case, because a lot of these characters, you know, you've got a college age kind of jock dude, you've got a woman that he's interested in college. They all look biographically very different from you, and yet you seem to have accessed their heads and their psychologies so well. And I wonder if you could just talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, well, you know, I started out, I think, writing a lot about men and the sort of crisis of masculinity that I think has accompanied the growth of feminism. So, and that's really been the story of my generation. So I'm in my mid-50s, and I think that the women I went to college with were kind of the first generation where they had been raised by mothers who thought of themselves as feminists. They had been raised to think that they could do anything, whereas their mothers' generations, you know, those women really had to fight for any kind of public role. They were, you know, most of them were kind of, even the educated ones were expected to give up their careers when they got out of college and became moms. So I feel like, you know, the story of my generation has been the story of feminism, really. And so I almost feel like writing about women has just been sort of the flip side of writing about men. I think both men and women are confused by the new rules and new sets of possibilities. But I think it's been more interesting to write about women just because I think women at least have this sense of possibility, and there's some power in redefining the role, whereas I think for a lot of men they've felt somewhat diminished by the, you know, if there's a zero-sum game in terms of cultural power, the fact that women have more means that a lot of men perceive themselves as having less. And I think, but on the other hand, women also, I don't have to tell any woman, you know, are struggle with the responsibilities that have come with these new possibilities, meaning, you know, now you're supposed to be everything.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, a lot of women have, I know, you know, who have struggled with balancing their careers and their families. And I think a lot of the characters I've written about in recent books, particularly, you know, Sarah in Little Children, Eve and Mrs. Fletcher, you know, these are educated women. Some of them have, well, Sarah is the one who feels like she has not made the most of her education and her potential, and she kind of channels all her dissatisfaction into this affair that she has, whereas Ruth and the abstinence teacher and Eve are women who do have jobs that give them some pleasure, but it's sort of come at the expense of their relationships. And so they're trying to also, you know, they're all kind of trying to find a happy balance between work and family. And I don't know, I just found it really interesting to be writing about women, and I'm not sure exactly why, but that's where the energy has been lately when I've started to tell these stories.
And kind of giving them their sexual power back, because there's so much, you know, kind of the cliche of the 46-year-old, 50-year-old woman is that, you know, she's kind of an asexual being who's raised her kids and is, you know, going to take up knitting and cats or something. And so to infuse her with her own desires and her own kind of complicated ideas about what she wants and what she's willing to do to get it and all of that, I thought was really, really wonderful.
Yeah, well, you know, so, you know, the big term in Mrs. Fletcher is MILF, you know, which is a, on the one hand, it's kind of a jokey term in popular culture that comes from, like, American Pie. But in the porn world, you know, it's a very popular category. And what it says is, you know, women don't stop being sexy when they turn 30 or turn 40 or even 50. And so even though, you know, I think a lot of women are uncomfortable with porn, there is some sense that in that space, you know, women remain, you know, sexually very desirable. And what happens is this word gets attached to Eve Fletcher. She gets an anonymous text that calls her a MILF, and it's very dirty, and she's offended by it. But she also realizes she's not quite sure what the term means, and she Googles it and kind of stumbles into this world of porn that includes lots of women her age kind of clearly submitting these homemade phone videos of themselves having sex. And Eve starts to think of herself, well, maybe I am that. And she kind of adopts this identity. She tries it on and looks at the world through the lens of, you know, this empowered MILF, and discovers that there are all kinds of sexual possibilities that she wasn't even aware of. She just had to tune in to that frequency. And it is a way for me to talk about identity, because I think one of the things that we were just talking about was, you know, how many more sexual identities there are now that we've decided that, you know, heterosexuality isn't the only kind of sexuality, and male and female aren't the only genders, you know, and it's like we've just expanded the possible number of identities that are sexually viable. And you know, the book is saying, yeah, you know, MILF is an identity. Eve goes from being a woman who feels overlooked and lonely to feeling like she has some sexual power, and that's not a small thing.
Right, right. The research for this must have been fantastic.
Yes. My joke is that it's the 10,000-hour rule in effect.
All the way across, you know, the board.
I know. Well, you know, I grew up even though it was a sexual revolution in the 70s, I grew up in a working-class Catholic world. And I think, you know, there was just a lot of anxiety and silence around sexual issues. So, you know, when I got to college and I started to meet gay people, I would say very confidently, well, there were no gay people in my high school. And, of course, I just grew up in a place where it just wasn't safe to come out. And so people, they may not have even known they were gay, or they were just deep, deep in the closet. But when I go to my reunions now, I meet a lot of people who are gay.
Right.
You know, and I think that goes for porn, too. Porn was not a regular part of my life. And I think, you know, occasionally when I would come across it, you know, it had that power that forbidden things have. And so I think when it became available online, you know, it just felt like Pandora's box was open. And I certainly, you know, I just found that I was, you know, very curious in a way that, you know, some other people I know weren't. And I discovered, I think, there's just a lot of information there. And I know sociologists are seeing, like, big data around porn is just hugely instructive about human sexuality.
Oh, for sure. Well, so there's some rule 37 or something. If it exists, there is porn of it, and there's no, you know, there really are no limits, I think, to.
Yeah, I just heard a podcast that featured a guy who had crunched a lot of numbers around that came from Pornhub and Google, and you know, among other things, he was just saying, like, it turns out that huge numbers of men are interested in you know, for lack of a better word, for in fat women, you know, and that, like, you wouldn't know that from the surface of our culture. You wouldn't know it from watching Hollywood movies. You wouldn't know it from looking at magazines, et cetera. You know, we've been taught by somebody that you know, that's not attractive. But I think it turns out that if you just have access to people's secret lives and their secret desires, that men have interest in a much wider variety of women and women's bodies than the culture normally would let on.
And I think, you know, to the corollary, how many women you think are turned off by porn versus how many women actually watch it. You know, I mean, the numbers of what people report versus the numbers of what's real and what they search for, I think, are totally often at odds with each other.
Yeah, and it's very generational. You know, I think when I was in college, it was the days of anti-porn feminism, and there was a sense that this was a very exploitive, objectifying, dirty business. And I think, you know, it certainly was in many ways, and it still remains that. On the other hand, there are lots of people, you know, voluntarily sharing pictures of themselves because we have the technology now. And I think one of the things that somebody said to me recently was, you know, with the advent of smartphones, basically everybody's a pornographer. You know, this is a friend of mine who's gay, and he says when he sometimes friends will be showing him pictures of their vacations, and it will inevitably, like, turn into, like, you know, pictures that he's like, I don't need to see this. You know, you know, whether people do it, you know, I remember when you needed Polaroids to have, you know, a private, you know, image that you wanted to keep of a lover, you know, and but now everybody has it, so if the urge is on you,
Yeah, you don't need the Kodak hut anymore.
why wouldn't you take a picture?
Right.
Though, of course, that leads to all sorts of other problems in terms of revenge porn and, you know, pictures being shared without permission.
So getting back to the book, some of this was written in third person, and Brandon's point of view was written in first person. You know, we kind of again had an array of points of view, so we got to kind of follow along on the cast of characters, which was great. But talk a little bit about that decision to have the majority of the book in third person and then put Brandon in first, which I really thought was effective.
Yeah, you know, it almost doesn't rise to the level of a decision. It was just an instinct that I had. Like, I felt like, oh, I can hear this guy's voice, and I just decided to go in that direction. And it wasn't until later that I started to think about rationalizing it, because I think when I'm writing, I'm really trying to shut off some of that critical part of my brain that would say, like, hey, why are you doing this? That's very distracting, or it's formally inconsistent. It's a problem. It just felt right to me. And later, when I had to think about it, when people would ask me, "Why did you do that?" You know, my answer would be, "It felt right." But the more distant and analytical answer is, I think it creates a jarring transition every time you go from Eve's mind to Brendan's mind, and that is, of course, it's a generational transition because he's 18 and she's 46. It's a gendered transition. You know, she's a woman, he's a man. It just creates this distance between the two of them that I think is very important to the book, which is they're a family, they're the two people who live in this house, they've shared their lives, and yet they seem to exist in entirely different psychological spaces. And you know, and I think that's just an important fact in the book, and I think it's an important fact in our culture to think about the ways in which, you know, generations live in different realities and genders live in different realities. It's kind of a daunting thing to see.
What was the point of entry of the book for you? Like, did it start with one of these characters, or did it kind of just start with the idea of trying to explore, sexuality in our new technologically infused culture, or kind of where did you start with it?
That is always so mysterious to me. I always feel like there need to be two ideas, and I think in some broad sense, I wanted to write about this phase of adulthood where your kids leave and you get to have a bit of a do-over. You get to say, okay, that chapter's over. Can my life be different? Do I want my life to be different? There's that part. And then I just think I was really thinking a lot about sex in college, because there was all that controversy that's ongoing about sexual assault in college and about hookup culture and about college as a sort of laboratory for all kinds of new sexual identities and behaviors. And I just felt like that combination of, a son in college dealing with all this stuff and a mom at home kind of wondering if she can reconnect with her own younger self, the self that, she psychologically links to college, just felt very promising to me. It felt like those two quests were related. We usually think of the parent staying home and the child going to college as living in very different realities. But I actually thought, oh no, they're both, starting some new chapter of their lives and trying to figure out who they are, and they're both, in some ways, trying to do it through their sexual adventures.
Yeah, right. And I really like the backdrop of the Senior Citizen Center because I feel like the sex is such a antidote to mortality. And from what I've heard, actually, a lot of sex goes on in senior living places, but wasn't the case as much here. But I do think that as we're bumping up against our mortality, and Eve is looking at aging and getting older, and where am I going to be, and where is my life headed? Sex is such a great psychological remedy against that, and it's so life affirming, and it's exciting, and it does take you back to sort of that teenage adrenaline fused excitement. And so putting those two ideas against each other, I thought was really, really wonderful.
I thank you. But I think it really meant a lot to the texture of the book too, because I think you're right. I think Eve is, 46 is a funny age. Some you're no longer young, but you're not old. But and she looks in one direction and she sees college kids, and she looks in the other direction and she sees, old people whose lives are winding down, and I just love that she's sort of literally caught in the middle there. And again, there's a third level of reality. The people at the senior center have not been exposed to a lot of the ideas that, Eve and Brendan have been exposed to in terms of, when a transgender speaker comes to the senior center, they're not welcoming, and they don't want to redefine these concepts that have been more or less stable throughout their entire lives. I just think, it was important to kind of have three generations rather than just two in this book.
Yeah, right. And I really, God, there's so much to love in here, but your humor is so wonderful. I mean, I was sitting alone in a restaurant the other day reading it, and I, the literal laugh out loud where people were looking over at me. There's, the dialogue is great. There was some line about friends with benefits. I don't even have a job with benefits. I was like, so great.
I had been working on the TV show The Leftovers, and I love the show, and it ended up being very funny in season three. I think
Oh,
one of
yeah.
the ways that the show developed over time was that we found a lot more opportunities for humor. But the first season was famously dark and depressing to the point where a lot of people just said, I can't take it. It's too heavy." And I was working on the show, and I'm very proud of it. But I was also thinking, like, I don't want to just become a TV writer. You know, I want to keep my novel writing self alive. And so I was sort of splitting my time between working on the show and starting a new novel that ultimately became Mrs. Fletcher. And one of my, I think, personal goals was just to reconnect with the comic voice that has been a part of my writing, but had gotten a little bit less so with Nine Inches and The Leftovers. My two most recent books were probably the two least funny books that I had written. And so I really had in my mind, like, I want this book to be funny. And it was, you know, and it was fun to write, and it has a kind of comic energy in the sense that even though there's a lot of unruly and difficult material, I think it is a book that ultimately thinks that its characters will be okay.
Yes, exactly right. We're drawing down on our time. I want to be respectful of your time. I mean, I could talk to you for all day, but I know you've got places
to be. A little bit longer.
So without giving anything of the ending away, just generalized talking about endings, I wonder if you often find the ending, and you could, because there's a resonant of the ending in the beginning of the book, and I wonder if, you know, just in general, you often look to the beginnings of novels to kind of see the path forward to finding the end of the book. Is there a way to talk about that without giving anything away?
Yeah, well, I think it's true, and one of the ways that my writing process is maybe different from some other novelists. A lot of other novelists, I think, tell me that they write a very sloppy first draft. They just kind of move through it without worrying about things being perfect, and just try to get to the end so that they kind of know the trajectory of the book, and so the next draft they can be much more deliberate. But I tend to write almost like a story writer. Like, I'll treat each chapter as an independent piece of work, and so I won't move to chapter two until I've written chapter one in its what feels like a final form. And so I'm kind of reading the book as I go through it, and I always feel like I'm leaving hints for myself that I can then pick up later on. But I usually try not to look too far ahead. I usually just say, okay, in chapter one, he drops her son off at college. You know, chapter two will be, well, okay, what's her life now? Or, however I might, I'll just have in mind, like, where does the book need to go now, rather than looking four or five steps down the road.
Yeah.
So I'm usually just writing, moving just one step at a time.
One step, okay, yeah. As you look across it, well, now that you've had two movies done and the miniseries done, and you're writing in the aftermath of all that, do you see this pretty visually? Like, do you now just see what you're writing as kind of a movie?
No, my answer to that is no more than I did at the beginning.
Okay.
I actually think, I recently looked back at the Wishbones, and it felt to me like quite familiar. Like, I hadn't changed as much as I thought I'd changed over all the years. And that book was written before I had anything adapted for the screen. I think my work has always been kind of visual and cinematic, and that was why it's adapted so well to the screen. But it hasn't actually changed, except maybe to become a little more literary, because becoming a screenwriter has made me more aware of the tools that are exclusive to the prose writer.
Well, that's interesting.
Kind of move in time very fluidly. You can delve into your character's, you know, inner monologue in a way that you can't on screen.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's interesting. And as you look across the kind of the arc of all of the books that you've written and the short stories you've written, do you feel like your kind of the central questions of life are similar, or do you feel like your work is adapting as you're, you know, either as you're aging or as you're interests kind of change, or do you feel like the big questions have remained the big questions throughout your life?
That's always a tough one. Like I saw some critic who was sort of saying, well, my books are, you know, each one is more or less the same, you know, and I kind of bristled at that, because I can see that they're, you know, if you go from Bad Haircut, which is a coming of age book about, you know, basically about male friendship, to a book like The Leftovers, there's really not a whole lot in common between those. On the other hand, I do think, you know, Election was an early book that was about a teacher and students, and you know, Abstinence Teacher had that element, and Joe College had that element, and Mrs. Fletcher has that element. You know, I think that, yeah, so I think the Times said, like, school sex in suburbia, and I felt like, oh, you know what? I'm not going to argue with that. I do have my obsessions, and you know, the fact is that there are writers who, you know, reinvent themselves with every book or have a really broad range. And then there are writers like, you know, I think Graham Greene comes to mind, or, you know, at times Philip Roth, you know, writers that you kind of know what you're going to get when you pick up their work. You know, there's a pretty consistent slice of the world that they're mapping out. You know, Faulkner, you know, what, so Alice Munro for sure. So I don't think that that's necessarily a bad thing to say that a writer has a subject or a set of subjects and a territory that he or she is kind of focused on. I mean, I think it's our limits that define us as much as our expansiveness, you know?
And if it isn't broke, don't fix it. I mean, people rush to read your books, and you know, and why wouldn't they? I mean, they're talking to, I don't know, a huge majority of our country, I think, can identify with everything that these people are grappling with, whatever stage of life they're at. You know, we're all suburbanites dealing with our own crap, and all of your books mirror that so well. All of the things that we're kind of scared to talk about and kind of don't want people to know that we're dealing with, and you know, it's all right here. So, no, I think that's
Yeah,
great
no,
too.
I appreciate that. I mean, I think, you know, I am writing about a certain slice of American life, and at least at times it's been held up as being kind of the mainstream. You know, I do think certain literary territories are overrepresented. You know, there are way too many books about young people in Brooklyn. You know, that's like a very small part of the country, you know, and I write about small town suburbia, usually not super wealthy. You know, so it's definitely a place where, you know, a lot of Americans, you know, live within that zone. And one of the things that Mrs. Fletcher is about certainly is these ideas that are coming from, you know, the elite precincts of the culture and filtering down to, you know, a more mainstream place, and you know, they receive, you know, and I'm just having characters, you know, grappling with these ideas that might be old hat in, you know, the English department in the Ivy League, but are certainly not old hat, you know, when it comes to, you know, community college or, you know, the senior center in this small town.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, The Leftovers was such a different texture than the other things that you've written, but I do always like these people that are kind of straddling different life stages, you know, that I mean, coming of age is certainly one life stage, but middle age is really a distinctly other life stage, and obviously the senior center too, but it's these people realizing, "Oh my God, I'm right on the threshold of this new life stage that I have to get used to." And that doesn't end when you're in high school or college. I mean, that keeps going your whole life when, you know, when your kids leave town. And I think those are such kind of scary and anxiety-provoking points of life. And you always zero in on exactly where those points of life are when people are in transition, that it's visceral.
Oh, good. Well, I really appreciate that. That's a nice way to think about it.
So, in terms of writing advice, having done now short stories, novel, I don't know how much you're involved in doing the screenplays for the movies or writing for the HBO series, but doing all of that writing, I wonder if there is advice you can leave us with that, you know, either has sustained you over time or things that you've learned in writing this, you know, either this most recent book or writing in general that you can part are writing listeners with?
I think maybe inherent in that question is the answer itself, which is I have really enjoyed in the, over the past several years, you know, shaking up my writing life and working on the. I was very involved in the TV show and was commuting out to LA for 2 weeks out of the month and working in a writer's room with a bunch of really smart, talented writers and. That was just such an eye-opening experience for me because I've been alone in the room and so, committed to exploring, you know, my own personal vision. And it was so interesting to turn over my work to this sort of group effort and see what amazing ideas other people came up with. And there were times when it was sort of humbling and but also always, you know, really exciting to see the ideas that emerged from other writers, and I felt like just opening myself to collaboration in that way was very revelatory and didn't at all detract from, you know, my own personal voice. You know, rather than see that as a threat, I kind of saw it as an opportunity. And then when I went back to do my own work, I think I felt, you know, the power of being in an individual voice that much more clearly.
And I really appreciated your comment about how much you saw what the novel form can do that maybe the screenplay can't do, or maybe, you know, you just don't have access to all of these characters' inner thoughts or kind of the, you know, the full spectrum of what novel writing can do. And maybe working on the screenplay, I don't know if it changed or informed or did something else to your writing of fiction or maybe made you appreciate it more, but I thought that was a really interesting insight. I hadn't thought about that before.
Yeah, no, it really did have that that effect. And on the other hand, all that collaboration was very exciting. I mean, it was, I guess, the way I think about it, because I'm so interested in music, was I felt like I was like part of a band and you know, the sound we made was just much bigger than the sound I made on my own. And there was just that kind of very visceral pleasure of engaging in the act of storytelling with other people. It's a very intimate, and at times exhilarating thing to do. And other times you're just sitting there, you know, frowning at each other and drumming your fingers on the table and feeling frustrated. But when it works, it was a very exciting thing to do.
That's very cool. Do you think Mrs. Fletcher will make it to the screen, or is she going to stay in the book?
I'm trying to develop it as a half-hour TV show with HBO. So
that's great.
We'll see how that goes. I had such a good time with The Leftovers, and I felt like that's definitely an area I want to explore a little more.
Absolutely. Tom Perotta, this was such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's a great conversation.
Thanks again.